Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
For years now, Donald Trump has insisted his favorite book is the Bible. But for years now, he has also been seemingly unable or at least unwilling to recall any of its specifics.
The whole Bible is an incredible, I joke very much so. They always hold up the Art of the Deal. I say my second favorite book of all time. But I just think the Bible is just something very special.
I'm wondering what one or two of your most favored Bible verses are,
well,
and why.
I wouldn't want to get into it because to me that's very personal. You know, when I talk about the Bible, it's very personal. So I don't want to get into
There's no verse that means a lot to you that you think about or cite.
The Bible means a lot to me, but I don't want to get into specifics.
Is there a favorite Bible verse or Bible story that has informed your thinking or your character through life, sir?
Well, I think many. I mean, you know, when we get into the Bible, I think many, so many.
An Old Testament guy or a New Testament guy?
Probably equal.
You might think that an aide would slip him a sheet of paper with something like, I don't know, John 3:16 on it, so Trump could at least pretend to know something about the Bible. But no. And that reality is part of what makes Trump's latest grift so amazing.
All Americans need a Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book. We must protect content that is pro-God. We love God, and we have to protect anything that is pro-God. We have to bring Christianity back into our lives and back into what will be again a great nation. I'm proud to endorse and encourage you to get this Bible. We must make America pray again. I think you all should get a copy of God Bless the USA Bible now and help spread our Christian values with others.
Now, Donald Trump hawking Bibles while actually never having opened one himself is ironic, but it is also not out of character. I mean, this is the man who's selling basketball shoes right now, and I'm not even sure his three-pointer exists. The reason Trump is Bible peddling and the reason it is interesting isn't because of the hypocrisy. The reason Trump and his Bible sales are interesting is because of the fine print here. This is the frequently asked questions page for this new Trump Bible. If you were wondering, this is the only Bible endorsed by Donald Trump, which may be alarming news. I don't know. But the thing that actually matters here is the very last question on this list. Is any of the money from this Bible going to the Donald J. Trump campaign for president? The answer is no. Despite the fact that Trump's ad for this Bible really feels like a political ad to make America pray again, etc. Despite that, money from the sale of these Bibles does not go to any political cause. It goes to a politician. It goes to Donald Trump. According to the New York Times, Trump gets royalties from Bible purchases, which is part of a licensing deal through a shell company. So the money is split between this Bible company and Donald Trump. At the end of the day, this is really just Trump getting his supporters to enrich him personally. And the reason I point this out isn't because I care particularly about Donald Trump making money off a bunch of Bibles. It's because this little shell game here is very much part of a pattern, and we are seeing it repeat itself in a big way that could impact the 2024 election. You probably remember that back in 2020, after losing the race, Trump launched what he called his official election defense fund. Between Election Day and January 6th, the Trump campaign sent millions of fundraising emails to supporters, sometimes as many as 25 emails a day. The fundraising pitch was that the Democrats want to steal the election and that this fund needed your money to fight back. Trump managed to raise $250 million with that sales pitch, but there was just one small problem with Trump's official election defense fund. It didn't exist.
I don't believe there is actually a fund called the Election Defense Fund.
Now, Trump really did raise $250 million, but only a small fraction actually went towards anything resembling fighting back or challenging the 2020 election. If you read the fine print while donating to Trump's official election defense fund, you would learn that before a single penny is given to Trump's efforts to fight the election results, the first $5,000 donated by any donor is split between the RNC and Trump's Save America PAC. In other words, if you sent in $200, none of that would go towards the Trump Defense Fund. Now, today, the New York Times is out with a very useful piece showing where all that money did go. And it turns out that all of that $254 million windfall Trump got from claiming the election was stolen, it turns out Trump funneled that money through a series of different accounts like his Save America PAC. The money was part of a little shell game that ultimately paid Donald Trump's personal legal expenses. He used it to fill the $90,000 a day hole in his pocket from the legal bills he has been incurring in his various civil and criminal cases. The other big showstopper in this piece today is that big pot of money, it is nearly gone. And now with those coffers nearly run dry, Trump is looking for another cash cow. Next month, Trump is set to hold a big ticket fundraising dinner with the RNC in Palm Beach, Florida. And the fine print on the invites to that dinner, well, that fine print is telling. This is the first major fundraiser since Trump got his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, installed as the co-chair of the RNC. And Laura Trump has since very publicly made clear that the RNC will not be paying any of Trump's personal legal bills. But again, look at the fine print. At this fundraiser next month, the invitation shows that the first $6,600 donated goes straight to Trump's campaign. And the next $5,000 donated after that go to Trump's Save America PAC, the entity that has been paying his legal bills. So in order to actually get money to the RNC at this RNC fundraiser, you first have to clear $11,600 in Trump's own piggy banks. So, okay, the RNC isn't paying Trump's legal fees, but it is not as simple as that. It is a shell game. Joining me now to discuss is Christy Greenberg, former federal prosecutor who served for over a decade in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, and Tim Miller, writer-at-large at The Bulwark and co-host of the Next Level podcast. Thank you guys both for being here. Christy, how is this legal? How can he keep saying this one thing and doing another?
Well, I think the big question here will be, looking behind all of this, as to who's coordinating it. Mm. If Donald Trump is coordinating between his campaign and these PACs that are supposed to be third parties and independent, the Save America PAC is an independent, even though he directs it, independent third party. If there is sufficient coordination and you could prove that, then maybe you would have something to say. These expenditures are not purely personal. These are really campaign contributions. And therefore, they should be subject to the limits of $5,000 that campaign contributions are subject to. So again, it seems to me, like you said, they're just trying to do an end run around yes. these various regulations. And it seems so transparent. The question is, will anybody look into this? Will the FEC look into this? Will any prosecutors look into this? It's unclear.
Can I ask a follow on that? Because we're on the eve, kind of the Stormy Daniels hush money payments case, which is $100,000+. We're talking about a whopping sum of money here that's being moved around various PACs and super PACs and, you know, campaign arms and, you know, Republican committees to ultimately help Donald Trump in his bid for the presidency.
Right.
Do you think the sort of the conversation around the Justice Department being, quote unquote, weaponized is actually going to steer potential prosecutors off a case like this that seems so much greater in magnitude than what's already going to trial?
Well, I mean, it feels like it already has, because remember, Jack Smith, as you pointed out, had served some subpoenas in connection with that non-existent, as it turns out, election defense fund. He had served some subpoenas and then he withdrew them. Yeah. And it was unclear why, because that seemed like such a clear-cut fraud. I questioned why that happened. I mean, perhaps it was optics. Perhaps he felt like he had such strong cases in the January 6th case and the national security case that he didn't want to seem as though he was trying to drain Trump of the ability to legally defend against those cases. You know, hard to say, but I questioned at that time because that seemed like such a clear wire fraud case that it seemed like it should be looked into, but maybe they just had limited resources and didn't like the optics of it. But I agree with you. This raises a lot of questions. Someone, somewhere, even if not the special counsel's office, because they're pretty busy, some prosecutors should be looking into this.
Merrick Garland, can you hear us? Tim, the other thing that I find astounding is that somehow Donald Trump, who makes a point, his campaign is predicated on the idea that he is so rich, he doesn't need any of this, he's a mogul, he's got all this cash. Why do working class Americans, why do Trump supporters continue to give this man money when it so clearly is paying for a legal defense that he himself could pick up the tab for?
Good question. You know, why do people continue to give money to, you know, grifting pastors at megachurches, too? You know, sometimes people don't like to admit that they've been had. I think that some of it is a shell, and it's not just a shell game in how he's moving the money around through the different organizations. It also is the fact that he's being dishonest with the supporters. And this segment is not happening on Newsmax, right? This segment is not happening on Fox. I mean, certainly there are some supporters that recognize that their dollars are going to his legal defense fund and his airplane and his, you know, fancy dinners at Mar-a-Lago, and they don't care because it's their way to give a middle finger to the people they don't like. But there are other people that are donating that literally believed that that money was going to an election defense fund, that there was fraud in the election, that literally believed that the country is under threat, it's under some invasion, and that they, you know, the little $10 donation they give is part of the effort to stop that invasion and to support candidates that are, you know, going to put in policies that they care about. There are some of these people, and there are some people, elderly people in particular, people that aren't internet savvy, that are literally getting conned, as the New York Times has reported, and others, where, you know, they think they're making one donation and actually they're having a monthly withdrawal taken from their account. You know, this has been happening over and over again. And so, you know, there are plenty of these reporters that are getting scammed. And I think that this is potentially a useful political issue for Democrats, frankly, because it undermines a core message of Donald Trump that he cares about these people.
Yeah, I mean, and look, Chrissy, the expenses aren't going anywhere, right? I mean, the cases remain ongoing, right? Trump seeks to drag these trials out because he doesn't want to actually be held accountable before November, but he's still got to continue paying his lawyers. He has settlements that he has, bonds he has to pay up. He has a $175 million bond in the New York AG's case, Tish James's case, the civil fraud case. I mean, on that case, what is your expectation in terms of Trump's ability to pay that without someone else putting a bond down for him?
Well, he asked for, when he filed his brief with the New York Court of Appeals, he said, I want $100 million. And so they have now given him $175 million bond. So figure he's close. And $75 million more, I would assume he'd probably be able to find a source of that. It can't be his campaign. His campaign cannot pay for that civil judgment because that was purely personal conduct. They can pay for campaign finances that are related to his conduct in the campaign or as an office holder, but they can't, his campaign can't pay for this. So I think, you know, he really is going to have to find other sources to be able to pay for that, which it's just insane to me, by the way, just that the bond was reduced for him to be able to do this, to go forward with his appeal. Because at the end of the day, this was a defendant who went in court and said his whole defense was, I'm too rich to defraud.
Right.
Because the banks just want to have a relationship with me. And my business is good enough. They don't care what's on these financial statements. They just want to do business with me because I'm so rich. And then he just said recently he has $500 million in cash. And then he's telling the court, I can't pay that amount for a bond. And then they reduce it without explaining why.
Yeah.
And that's just head scratching that a defendant who made that kind of defense, who Don Jr. basically put on a timeshare presentation about the business empire and every property and all these iconic assets. And then, yeah, to then come back and say, when it's time to pay up, I got nothing.
I can't do it. And meanwhile, Trump supporters are starting GoFundMe pages. It defies logic. But there is a very practical campaign implication here, Tim, which is the robbing Peter to pay Paul aspect of all of this, which is funneling money away from his own campaign and from down ballot Republicans so that he can pay for his legal defense. And I do wonder, you know, when you look at the reality here, Biden and the DNC combined cash on hand, $97.5 million. Trump, $44.8 million. I mean, numbers are often abstract, especially at that magnitude. But Tim, you know from campaigns, like that would seem to have a meaningful difference in terms of how these two campaigns can operate in the coming months.
Yeah, and there really is a limit to the pot, right? There's only so many small dollar donors to go around. And Trump's campaigns, month to month, is showing him losing ground with small dollar donors in an election year where he should be gaining. So I do think this makes difference. I'm a little bit suspect of oftentimes how much marginal differences make on cash in a presidential campaign, given just the scope of information and how much money is being spent. But eventually you get to a point where there's actually a meaningful difference. And I think that right now, for one example, Joe Biden's team is on the air right now. They are trying to drive a message about what he accomplished and maybe address some of the age questions. And Donald Trump's campaign isn't, because his money is going to, you know, pay a bunch of lawyers and a bunch of grifters that work for him. And so I think that is, at least on the margins, and what might be a close race could certainly be meaningful.
Yeah, you know, when the state Republican chair in Michigan is ringing the alarm bell that, hey, someone needs some ads in this state, you got a problem. Christy Greenberg, yeah. Tim Miller, thank you both for joining me tonight. I appreciate you. Coming up, things are looking up for the Biden campaign, while the Republican Party chair in Michigan, as we just discussed, is saying, when is the Trump-run RNC going to start doing something in this state? Anything. I'm going to break all of that down with Obama campaign manager David Plouffe. That's next.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Is it going to be the position of the RNC in 2024 that the 2020 election was not fairly decided or that it was stolen somehow?
Well, I think we're past that. I think that's in the past. We learned a lot. The past is the past. And unfortunately, we had to learn a couple of hard lessons in 2020.
Stolen election claims? That's all in the past. So says the new RNC co-chair, Lara Trump. Just hours after speaking with my colleague, Garrett Hake, we got this reporting in The Washington Post. Those seeking employment at the Republican National Committee have been asked in job interviews if they believe the 2020 election was stolen, according to people familiar with the interviews, making the false claim a litmus test of sorts for hiring. So you want to work at the RNC? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? What are your biggest weaknesses? Did Joe Biden steal the election from Donald Trump? We'll reach out if we have any other questions. That is how things are going right now for one of the two major parties in the next presidential election. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, the Biden campaign is focused not on the last election, but the coming one. And recent polls show President Biden gaining ground across the country. A new Bloomberg Morning Consult poll out today shows Biden either tied or leading within the margin of error in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, all states Biden was trailing in just a few weeks ago. Joining me now is David Plouffe, former Obama campaign manager and host of the Campaign HQ podcast. David, thanks for joining me tonight. I was stunned by this warning that Pete Hoekstra, the Michigan Republican Party chair, issued to the Trump campaign, effectively saying they haven't made any significant general election investments in Michigan. This is neither the campaign nor the RNC. They haven't transferred any money to the state to help bolster its operations heading into the general. There are no specific programs in place to court voters of color, and there is no general election field staff in place. How meaningful is that from a campaign perspective, David?
Well, and obviously Hoekstra, you know, has won races himself, so he knows how to put together a campaign. I mean, that's a searing indictment. Now, Alex, for those of us who have run campaigns, sometimes it's humbling to admit that they really make a difference on the margins. You know, they don't change big things, but the polls you just showed suggest we could be heading to a race. Let's say that's 48 to the winner in a bunch of battleground states, 47 and 5 third party. So that's where campaigns matter. You know, in the Obama campaigns, we often used to talk to them as they're the field goal unit. They're not going to get you 2 touchdowns, but they could be worth 1, 2, 3 points. And so right now, Joe Biden's campaign is running ads on the air. Donald Trump's isn't. We just heard in Michigan, one of the 6 or 7 states that will determine our next president, there's nothing going on. And that's not going to change because all Trump cares about is himself and sucking up this money to defray his legal costs. So, again, it's not going to change big things. But if this race is like the one we just had in 20 and like the one we had in 16, campaigns matter a lot around the margin. And so that's why I think you're going to see increasingly Republicans get really concerned. And of course, it just doesn't affect Trump. It really affects down ballot people who are harmed by his selfish, lackadaisical political effort.
What do you attribute the Biden upswing to? I mean, again, we're talking incremental here. This is within the margin of error. But nonetheless, it does feel like an inflection point. Do you think is it the halo effect of the State of the Union, or is it American voters having better vibes about the economy? I mean, how do you look at the landscape there for Biden?
I think it's probably 3 things, Alex. I think Democrats, I don't think swing voters, but I think a lot of Democrats are more enthused now because of the State of the Union, because the president's out there campaigning, number one. Number two, I think voters do feel slightly better about their personal economic situation. And then 3, I think probably the biggest factor is people are really zeroing on in the fact that this is the rematch. It's a rematch, by the way, that a lot of Americans don't want, but it's the one they're faced with. And at the end of the day, I do think there's enough Americans out there who basically, even if they don't approve of Joe Biden's performance as president, who say, I just can't sign up for 4 more years of the Trump circus. It's not going to help me or my family. So I think you're starting to see some voters, even though it's very, very early, but I think you're seeing more voters zero in on the fact that there is no fantasy here of alternative options. These are the 2 candidates and you have to make a choice.
To that end, Politico is reporting that Biden is kind of pursuing an unusual strategy to remind Americans of what was happening 4 years ago. Usually you want to be future facing. Relitigating COVID doesn't seem like something the American public necessarily wants. But the Biden campaign is effectively betting, and this is according to Politico, that they can turn the issue of COVID into a referendum on Trump's overall competence, reminding the American public how Trump behaved in the emergency. From a strategy perspective, do you think there is peril in doing that, given the anguish and the trauma that I think a lot of people still feel when we think of the beginning of the COVID pandemic?
Well, you have to do it carefully. And this is a very unique race. I mean, the last time we had 2 presidents running against each other was 1896, I believe. So it's been a long time. We have 2 incumbents. And so in that regard, yes, Joe Biden has to make clear every voter out there says, hey, if you give me 4 more years, here's what I'm going to do for the economy, for healthcare, for the environment, range of issues. But you've got to put Trump on trial and his conduct as president. And why I think this is important, if done artfully, is when you listen to Trump talk about his presidency, he wants to forget the year 2020. So you can't let him do that. You got to put this in front of people and say, listen, bad things are going to happen that are out of control in the next 4 years. They just always do. And do you really want this guy who mishandled it in kind of a historically awful way, you know, to be back? And a Trump who's more diminished, who will feel even less accountability, who said he's going to surround himself with loyalists. By the way, you showed that RNC pledge about the 2020 election. There's no doubt that if Trump wins, they're going to ask the same thing of everybody who wants to work in the government. And so that's what will be faced. So again, I don't think you want to make it maybe the cornerstone of your campaign, but Trump is trying to avoid 2020. And I do think it's important, but you can tie that to the future, which is here's how he acted then. Here's how it harmed the country then. And he's going to do the same thing if he's given the reins one more time.
Remind people that he urged Americans to inject bleach into their veins.
That's amongst other things, yes.
That is Donald Trump, ladies and gentlemen. David Plouffe, thank you for your expertise, my friend. It's great to hear from you. Coming up, you may recognize this picture of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his conservative buddies smoking cigars at his billionaire benefactor's lakeside resort. But what about this photo from real life. What it says about the state of judicial ethics in our post-Roe America is coming up next.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list. Teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Take a look at this photo. It's a lot like an optical illusion. The longer you look at it, the more you see. There's Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas right in the middle, swearing in his protege, James Ho, to be a judge on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Ho has his hand on the Bible held by his wife, Allison, in the home of Justice Thomas's billionaire benefactor, Harlan Crow. The year is 2018. Now, Judge Ho would go on to play a crucial role in trying to restrict access to medication abortion across the United States. Not only did Judge Ho agree that the FDA improperly expanded access to abortion pills in 2016 and 2021, he was the only judge on that court to conclude that right-wing doctors in this case, the Alliance for Defending Freedom, suffered injury because women had access to abortion medication. That case went before the Supreme Court yesterday, where even those judges seemed skeptical that the plaintiffs even had the standing to bring this case before the court, which makes Judge Ho's decision there appear that much more unusual. And now we are learning that Judge Ho's wife, Allison Ho, an attorney with the Federalist Society or with a Federalist Society ties, is linked to what else? The Alliance Defending Freedom. The Guardian newspaper reports that from 2018 to 2022, that group made at least six payments to Mrs. Ho. It is unclear what exactly the group paid her to do, but Judge Ho says the money given to his wife was then donated to charity. Wherever that money ended up, it does not change the fact that the judge who was deciding a court case brought by a right-wing group is married to someone being paid by that same right-wing group. Joining me now is Melissa Murray, professor at NYU Law and a co-host of the Essential Strict Scrutiny podcast. Melissa, thanks for being here. How in heavens is this not a breach of ethics?
Well, again, she is his spouse. Spouses are allowed to have paid income from other sources. This appears to be a series of honoraria, but it does seem odd that Judge Ho did not even consider the optics of what this looks like and perhaps thought maybe this would be an opportunity to recuse himself from this particular case, which he did not. All of this suggests that the very thin rules we have for judicial recusal probably need to be beefed up. And you recall a few months ago, we had all of the Supreme Court sort of making some gestures toward a code of conduct, which actually turned out to not really be a code of conduct at all. Again, it seems like there is a real need for judicial reform across the board, not just at the Supreme Court, but in the lower federal courts for toothier rules regarding this sort of thing.
It surprises me. I mean, I guess it shouldn't, but that these effectively activists like Matthew Kaczmarek, who's another judge that's just been rubber stamping a conservative lawsuits in search of a sort of broader policy change across the country, that these judges don't even hide the activism at this point.
Yeah.
What is it about this moment in time that that licenses them to feel so emboldened, do you think?
So I think it's a lot of things. So one, we have to recall that during the Trump administration, the selection of federal judges was essentially outsourced to Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, which we've heard about before and you've talked about on this show before. Those judges were vetted to be movement conservatives. So what they are doing now, what they feel emboldened to do, is exactly what they were put on the bench to do. So there is a kind of comfort there. They know what they're supposed to do. They know the mission. They've chosen to accept it, and they're doing it. The other thing that I think is worth thinking about here, this case that you just talked about, the Mifepristone case, was heard at the Supreme Court yesterday. You're right. Judge Ho was totally out there with his view of the injury that these doctors allegedly suffered. And it seems very likely that the court is going to issue a very stern rebuke, that this is not the kind of injury that they look for these cases. But the Fifth Circuit and judges like Judge Ho, who are so extreme, actually provide and do a service for the United States Supreme Court, which has been steadily moving to the right. Mm-hmm. When these lower courts are really out there, like truly pushing the envelope, as Judge Ho did, the court can then rein it in a little, offer up what seems like moderation, get heralded by the press for their moderation, when in fact the court is still moving to the right. And so they provide essential cover, and we cannot forget that.
They shift the Overton windows.
Like, yeah, I mean, Overton French doors. This is not an Overton window anymore. Like, the doors are wide open, and the court is walking through, moving to the right, and we just don't see how far to the right they're actually going.
There's also something, like, probably slightly pernicious in terms of what's happening in the context of judicial appointments, right?
Yeah.
Judge Ho is, like, so out there, it's almost like he's auditioning for a role in the Supreme Court. Like,
he is
look
auditioning.
How crazy
no,
I can be.
That is exactly right. I have said this on the show before. If Donald Trump wins the presidency, or any Republican wins the presidency in 2024, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who are in their 70s, are very, very likely, almost certainly, to step down. And when they do, you have people waiting in the wings like Judge Ho, who has been auditioning for this. And that's exactly what these sort of outlandish gestures are. They are auditioning for the next spot on the Supreme Court to be Donald Trump's guy going forward.
It's a audition tape, if anything. I want to get your thoughts on the way in which, I mean, so these activists who are cloaked in judges' robes are doing their part to move the conservative agenda forward, but they're not actually doing a great political service for the GOP on whole, right? I mean, you see these judges, whether it's the judge in Alabama ruling on IVF or even Judge Ho in the Fifth Circuit and making their decisions on Mifepristone, they put into the center spotlight these issues of reproductive freedom that may be things that conservative activists want, but are terribly politically, terrible politically for the Republican Party. I mean, we see evidence of that last night in Alabama, where Marilyn Lanz, who's going to be a guest on Lawrence O'Donnell's show in the next hour, flipped a Republican state house seat in the state of Alabama, largely on the issue of IVF.
No, I think that's exactly right. The Republican Party recognizes that its domestic agenda is not one that plays well to the electorate. The electorate is far more moderate than what the Republican Party is doing right now. But that might not matter so much if you have the courts. Like, the courts are by design a minoritarian institution. But what the Republicans have banked on is that they can do and prosecute through the courts what they could not do in majoritarian politics. So the goal on the other side for progressives is you not only have to win elections, you have to win decisively, and then you have to turn your attention to rolling back the conservatism of the courts.
It is a multi-pronged effort and potentially a multi-pronged solution. Melissa Murray, it is always good to see you, my friend. Thank you for your time tonight. Coming up, Republican-led border policies are having a devastating effect on migrants seeking asylum in the U.S., and increasingly, it is in the form of sexual violence. We're going to have a special report on that from the Mexican side of the U.S. border right after the break. Today, a federal appeals court ruled that a hugely controversial Texas law known as SB 4 must remain blocked while legal challenges against it continue. If it is allowed to go into effect, SB 4 would criminalize immigration in America's largest border state by giving Texas police the power to arrest and jail migrants suspected of entering the U.S. illegally. And it marks an unprecedented power grab at the state level. At the federal level, Donald Trump is also promising that if reelected, he too will use local police to arrest migrants as part of his massive deportation plan.
As president, I will carry out the largest domestic deportation operation in American history. If they don't go back to their countries, we will never get back our country.
Migrants who are escaping violence and poverty and political uncertainty often cannot go back home. So what these types of policies do is force migrants to wait in parts of Mexico near the U.S. border, hoping to one day sort out their immigration status. And they are in parts of Mexico where dangerous cartels are systematically exploiting migrants with devastating consequences. This is a special report from our MSNBC contributor, Paula Ramos, and I want to warn you that some parts of the story are difficult and disturbing to hear.
So we just crossed from Brownsville, Texas, over to Matamoros. Right now, we're in the state of Tamaulipas, which is considered one of the most dangerous places in Mexico, more than anything because of the cartel violence that's taking place here. Now, every single person that we've talked to on the ground is telling us that the rate of sexual violence against migrants is escalating. It's increasing. It's getting worse by the day. So we're on our way to a refugee shelter to understand the impact that it's having on the migrants that are crossing from these border towns into the United States.
Maria, her husband, and their two children say they had to leave Guatemala last year after receiving death threats from the same gang that had already killed nearly half of her family.
No traíamos zapatos, no traíamos ropa, nada.
They traveled north, hoping to be near the U.S. border as they waited for their official immigration appointments, a crucial part of seeking asylum. They had no idea the worst part of their journey would take place just feet away from Texas.
Ya puestos aquí en Tamaulipas, en Reynosa, se sube un grupo. Se cruzó una camioneta blanca y subieron vestidos de negro.
¿Quiénes?
Y empezaron a decir, somos los del Golfo.
¿El cartel del Golfo?
Sí.
¿Estaban armados?
Sí, con pistolas en mano. Y mi marido me quedaba viendo y me dice, nos van a matar.
Porque usted en esos momentos, su marido pensaba que ahí...
Nos iban a quitar la vida. Y empezaron a quitarlo la ropa. Me desvistieron toda delante de él y me empezaron a golpear. Porque yo les decía que no traía dinero. Y ellos me decían, pásame el teléfono, vamos a contactar a tu familia para que pague tu rescate. No tengo quien pague rescate. Entonces me van a decir, nos vas a pagar con cuerpo. Empezaron a violarme más de 20 personas. Y me decían, esto te pasa por no pagar. Y para que recuerdes que el territorio mexicano se respeta. Yo les decía, ya no puedo más. Déjeme, por favor.
¿Usted tiene marcas del ataque que sufrió y de las violaciones?
Sí. Tengo en mi cabeza, en mi rostro, en mis pies, en mis manos. Me abrieron aquí también. Querían meter drogas para que yo pasara. Yo les dije que no.
Many of the migrants in the shelter have endured similar situations.
¿Cuánto tiempo estuviste secuestrada?
Como casi un mes.
¿Un mes?
Sí. Porque no tengo dinero, entonces me abusó de mí.
En ese mes que estuviste secuestrada, ¿te violaron muchas veces?
Como 4 veces.
¿Había más mujeres contigo?
Sí, había 3 mujeres conmigo.
¿Y las 4 estuvieron abusadas también?
Sí.
What's happening to these women might not be a coincidence. Cartels have developed a systematic, organized method to kidnap and collect ransom from migrants on their way to their immigration appointments.
Ahorita se están subiendo muchos a los autobuses y preguntando si vienen a las citas. Algunas personas dicen que sí y las bajan. Les checan sus maletas, les quitan todo su dinero, les pegan para poderles también mandarle ese video a sus familiares para que vean que es verdad que están secuestrados.
Doctors Without Borders has seen this crisis up close. From October to December of 2023, they recorded a 70% increase in consultations for sexual violence in Matamoros and Reynosa compared to the prior 3 months. The first 2 months of 2024, they have already seen nearly 70 cases.
I just got back from talking to 3 asylum seekers, and at least 2 of them have been sexually assaulted. Is that what you guys are seeing on the ground too?
Yeah, It's true. I mean, when we have the consultations, our patients also tell us their stories, which are quite traumatizing.
The violence is creating a new crisis for many migrants, unwanted pregnancies.
Do you offer pregnancy tests?
It is part of the protocol that we follow. It's actually the first medical treatment.
And does Doctors Without Borders also offer access to abortions or abortion pills? Is that something that's part of the work that you do?
We are actually very concerned all over the world, wherever we operate. We are very concerned about the unwanted pregnancies. We try to ensure that services are being offered to the women, and also to ensure that we ourselves adhere to the laws and norms of the country.
What many migrants don't know is that once they cross that border, a line that represents security, dreams, and opportunities, they're walking into the realities of post-Roe America.
¿Conoces sobre las leyes de aborto en Estados Unidos en estos momentos, en Texas?
No.
MSNBC contributor Paulo Ramos joins me next to talk about Trump, migrants, and what happens next. Stay with us. Throughout the years, Mexican cartels have leveraged the long waiting periods that asylum seekers often face on the Mexican side of the U.S. border. And today, these cartels are increasingly kidnapping migrants for ransom and weaponizing sexual violence as yet another form of extortion. Joining me now is Paula Ramos, MSNBC contributor and host of MSNBC Field Report. Paula, it's so great seeing you. You're bringing back stories that are not being told and need to be told as we have this raging debate about immigration and don't actually talk about the people involved here. What did you see on the border in terms of the sexual violence? The story that we played earlier was harrowing.
Terrible.
And I wonder if you could talk sort of broadly about the picture you saw when you were there.
Yeah, so when you think about the women that we just saw, I think of this image, right? These are women that are sort of stuck in between two walls. Mm-hmm. On the Mexican side of the border, they're faced with this incredibly vicious sexual violence. And then when they look the other way, when they look at the American side of the border, they're faced with post-Roe America. And so the product of that is that suddenly you're seeing this growing group of migrant women that are stepping into post-Roe America with rape-related unwanted pregnancies.
God.
And the reason why, and that's what we found in our reporting, is because there is this very alarming spike of sexual violence against migrant women. That's something that Doctors Without Borders told us, lawyers are telling us that, activists told us, the migrants themselves. And the difference now is that, you know, cartel violence has always been a norm.
Yeah.
If you go to the border, that's the norm. The difference now is that the cartels are very explicitly weaponizing sexual violence as yet another form of extortion, torture, to get what they want.
Can you talk a little bit about how the cartels functionally operate?
It's very simple, right? And some people won't want to hear this. The longer migrants wait on the Mexican side of the border, the more the cartels profit. Unfortunately, cartel violence is very deeply intertwined with the U.S. failed immigration policy and failed asylum seeking process. And so this is what happens, right? The cartels have leveraged the very long waiting times that immigrants are faced with on the Mexican side of the border because of policies like Trump's Title 42, Remain in Mexico, and now Biden's CBP One application, which essentially pushes migrants right now to wait on the Mexican side of the border as they're waiting for their immigration appointments. And so as migrants wait, and as they adapt to the different U.S. policy changes, so too do the cartels. Through that time, they have developed simply more sophisticated and organized methods of violence. They know the routes. They know the buses. They know when the immigration appointments are. And so it used to be that migrants could just pay with cash when you were held hostage. But now you have to pay with your body.
Right, because you don't have the cash.
Because you don't have the cash. And that violence is not just more vicious. It's not just more terrifying. But now the problem is that we are feeling the ramifications of that violence. Now, we are the ones that are faced with these migrant women that are carrying those pregnancies. So what do we do?
And have nothing. And they come to a state like Texas where their options are nil.
Are nil. Exactly.
Effectively, what you're telling me is that immigration policy is so broken, is forcing these extraordinarily long waiting times. There's no diminished appetite for decreasing those wait times, by the way, on either side of the aisle here in the U.S. And migrants are effectively preyed upon by these cartels. Are they, I mean, is there any protection for them? Is there any sort of recourse for them as they effectively lie waiting to be preyed upon by dangerous cartels?
No, anyone that walks, and precisely, I think that's something that President Biden should have done when he visited the border, right? You can say everything you want. We can talk about policy, but go to the other side and you will see this. And so I think it's very important to understand that, you know, no matter how conservative you are at the border, no matter how hard you want to, you know, make it for these migrants to come to the U.S., that only benefits the cartels. Migrants will continue to come. You know, the type of desperation we just saw on our screens, that is not deterred by walls and policies and policy debates. It's not. People will continue to migrate north. And so what do?
The desperation is so acute, and it is driving people to do things that are debasing their own, that force them to debase their own humanity. And we are not looking at this. We're not talking about this at all. Your reporting is really so essential. I'm so grateful for everything you do to shine a light on this, Paola. Really, really important stuff. Thanks for making the time tonight.
Thank you so much.
That is our show for this evening.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.